Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's January 8th, 2020 program. Implicit bias in the schools, in the courts, and in society. This is the 15th program of our 2020-2021 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and our sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page, and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 on Mondays at 7 p.m. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, University of Oregon, Peace Health, and Lane Community College, as well as generous support from the City of Eugene and from Lane County. Today's program focuses on implicit bias. The recent killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many other unarmed African Americans have heightened awareness of systemic racism and its foundation, implicit bias. Implicit biases are unconscious attitudes and stereotypes that can manifest in the criminal justice system, in workplaces, in school settings, and in healthcare systems. Implicit biases are based on many factors, including race, gender, and sexuality. We can deal with and hopefully reverse implicit biases only when we see how they impact thoughts and decisions. Removing these biases is a challenge, especially because we often don't even know they exist, but research reveals potential interventions and policies and processes to guard against implicit bias. Today's speakers include Dr. Eric Gervin, Dr. Rhonda Neese, and Justice Adrian Nelson. Biographical information on our presenters is available at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. I would like to thank Joel Corin for coordinating today's program. Each of our three guests will begin with a brief opening statement, and we will follow up with a question and answer period. Professor Gervin, we'll start with you.
Thank you for having us. So I'm here today to talk about implicit bias, and I'm going to talk about implicit bias from a general standpoint and also a pretty broad standpoint. So one way to think about implicit bias is it's the automatic assumptions that we make about other people based on the groups that we observe them to belong in or we think that they belong in. That's pretty abstract, and it's easier to make more concrete and perhaps more concrete in the particular time we're in right now to think about it in terms of, for example, political groups. So if you imagine yourself driving down the street and the car in front of you has a bumper sticker that suggests that the owner of that car belongs to a different political group than you do, perhaps a Trump-Pence 2020 bumper sticker, or a Biden-Harris 2020 bumper sticker, depending on your political persuasion. What our brains will do, and what you probably can think back in on your own life and think about, is our brains will fill in lots of information or assumptions about what that person is likely to believe, what their views are, what their positions are on particular issues and other things, none of which you actually know in the moment because you don't know that person. And so when we're talking about implicit biases, the first thing we think about is those automatic associations. You walk down the street, you see somebody that's dressed in a particular way, your brain comes up all kinds of automatic assumptions about what that person's characteristics are, what job they might have, and other things. So if we think about that implicit bias and those automatic assumptions, the question is, why do we have them and why might they be problematic? Because those are questions that often come up a lot. So the reason that we have implicit biases or these kinds of automatic assumptions is just part of the way that our brain organizes information in the world. So our brain tends to categorize everything, not just people, but we categorize all things as cars, trucks, chairs, animals into dogs, cows, et cetera. And that's part of healthy brain functioning is to be able to look at different things, understand that they belong to a member of a more general category, and then and be able to essentially process them that way. So we do it because it's efficient and it's a natural part of the way that the brain works. And a lot of times it turns out to be pretty functional, which is why our brain does it. If you're walking down the street and you're trying to decide whether to cross the street or not, and you look for oncoming traffic, right? It might make sense to distinguish between pedestrians, bikes, and automobiles of some kind, because they have different meanings about your safety and whether it's okay to cross and how fast they're going and those kinds of things. So you can make some basic assumptions about how they're likely to affect you based on their general categorizations you make. And it doesn't matter that much the specifics about them, right? What color they are, what specific make or model of a car they are, those kinds of things. Just having those general assumptions about them helps you navigate your daily life without having to think too much about it. Where the problems come in is when we do that with people, and we do that in a way where we tend to have some assumptions about their characteristics that we might get from a variety of sources. I can talk about that in a minute. But then we tend to think about, or consciously or unconsciously, begin to treat people as if they have those characteristics, even if we don't know that they do or not. So examples of that, and these relate effectively to stereotypes. So examples of that, I'll go back to the political sphere, right? We might, if we see a bumper sticker or something that signals that somebody is a Republican, we might imagine that they have particular viewpoints on, for example, gun ownership, and also on the environment, and maybe whether or not people should eat meat, example, vegetarianism. And it may be that all of those are completely wrong about that person. Because one thing we know from a lot of social science research is that there tend to be a lot of differences within groups, many more differences than we imagine. And so we might not stereotype someone who's a Republican as somebody who maybe thinks that we don't need to, that people shouldn't own guns, or has particular views around gun safety, or that they might be vegetarian. There certainly are Republicans who have those beliefs, and vice versa for Democrats. Right, so we look at these social categories, we make assumptions about them. And then if we behave or act on those assumptions that might be wrong with respect to individuals, it can cause us to discriminate against them. It can cause us basically to make decisions about them that are based on our assumptions, not based on their actual characteristics. And those decisions might be immediate, or they might be more far-reaching, such as policy decisions. Part of our schedule for today is to talk about the potential impacts of implicit bias on different domains in society, including education and the court system. But we might think about, okay, if we have assumptions, if we make assumptions about what kind of people are up to no good in a particular setting, that may cause us to be more wary or skeptical when we meet those people. And that may cause some self-fulfilling prophecies. People who tend to be treated more skeptically, more wary, don't feel welcome, don't feel like they belong when they interact, and then they themselves are standoffish, and we get a self-perpetuating or self-replicating cycle, self-fulfilling prophecies based on those assumptions. It can also cause us to make assumptions about where it is that we need to provide particular resources, right? Who's deserving of particular resources? And those can be positive, negative resources. So policing, for example, in the news a lot, right? Where we allocate our law enforcement resources, where we allocate our support resources for people. And to the extent that these are about, these relate to those automatic assumptions, they can lead us to treat people differently based on those characteristics that we imagine that they have or assume that they have. So that's essentially what we think about when we think about implicit bias and why it might be problematic to have it, and where it comes from. There are also just some general discussions around what do we do about implicit bias, these automatic assumptions, because of what our brains do in terms of categorizing. We can't necessarily stop that. And so what we can do at some level is try to challenge the assumptions themselves. And often that goes back to, it's one of the oldest interventions in psychology for reducing intergroup conflict or conflicts like that, is to try to get people to actually interact with one another. This was the idea behind Brown versus Board of Education and school desegregation and a lot of other concepts in the Middle East, for example, during World War II in terms of soldiers. What's called this idea of intergroup contact, where if we get people living and working and interacting together as members of the same team, they learn that people from other groups are people. right? And they learn that some of them are smart and not, and some of them are funny and not, and just like everyone else. And that tends to break down those assumptions and cause us to treat other people maybe more differently than we ought to. And so that kind of intergroup contact is one of them, by challenging those assumptions. The other category of things that people tend to do to try to reduce the effects of implicit bias is to try to help us to make better decisions in the moment. And this can include lots of things like give ourselves decision guides. So we don't just go with our gut, because going with our gut can emphasize the impacts of those assumptions. Instead, what we might do is give ourselves, again, essentially a checklist. And we go through to focus our attention on particular characteristics that might matter and remind us that we should actually assess them and evaluate them, not make assumptions about them as we're going through our decision-making processes. So a lot of organizations will essentially try to do these kinds of things, either more diversity with people interacting on teams to try to address those assumptions, or provide people, design their policies and practices so that people have ways to help them focus on the characteristics that matter, and not just assumptions about them, but actually looking into those assumptions. Hopefully that gives you a general idea of the concept of implicit bias. And now we're going to go to Dr. Rhonda Neese to talk about that in a particular educational domain.
Thank you, Dr. Gervin. I appreciate you setting up that frame for us. And yes, everything that you're speaking about, we see obviously within our school systems. So when we see implicit bias come up in the treatment of students within schools, either through their interactions with their teachers or with their peers, what we often see, especially in classroom behaviors and interactions, is that implicit bias comes out as harsh and disproportionate discipline towards students of color, students with disabilities, students living in poverty, and those struggling academically. Those tend to be the recipients of disproportionate and harsh disciplinary practices. And when we say harsh and disproportionate, we mean that when we see a Black child and a white child engaging in the same behaviors that their teacher may deem as inappropriate for the classroom environment, we see that our Black students more oftentimes receive discipline that involves exclusion from the classroom, that involves exclusion from the learning or social environment, and that is harsh in comparison to what their white peer receives. Now, schools have a phenomenal opportunity to use their data that they collect on disciplinary actions in a way to evaluate this. And we see schools and districts and even state departments doing this in a number of ways. By disaggregating student referral data, we're able to see by behavior, by time of day, when our students who are more susceptible to receiving harsh and disproportionate discipline. So those students of color, students living in poverty, we can see when that disproportionate discipline tends to happen by time of day, by behavior. And what we see nationally is that implicit bias oftentimes appears in situations that are much more subjective. So in schools, they're oftentimes referred to as the three D's of subjectivity. It's defiance, disruption, and disrespect. Behaviors that are not so much Black and white, but that there is personal interpretation. And those behaviors oftentimes are the ones in which we see the effects of implicit bias on the receipt of discipline that students receive. You know, when we also look at national data, we see that the impact of implicit bias on our students, you really see where the intersectionality of race and poverty and disability come together. So in one national data sample, they found that nationally, about 18% of students with disabilities had been suspended during their schooling period. However, one in five districts in the United States suspended over 50% of its Black male students with disabilities. So you see the intersection come together in which it's inappropriately and disproportionately impacting specifically our students that need to be in school the most and that deserve the most support. We also see, when you were mentioning that self-fulfilling prophecy, that human behavior is contextual and context specific, right? We have children, just like when we were all in schools, kids who will work very, very hard for one teacher and are happy to do nothing for the other one. And we oftentimes see that difference because of the relationships that students have with their teachers. We see students working incredibly hard for teachers who set the bar high, who make them feel like they can achieve, that they will succeed, and that they will be there to support them throughout that and make students feel that they belong and that they are welcome and that they are liked. And then we see those exact same students do nothing for the teacher who makes them feel like they are a burden in that class. And they play into those behaviors, right? Just like you had mentioned, Dr. Gervin, any human being, especially children, if we make them feel bad, they will start to behave badly, right? Or if they're excluded from the learning environment, when we bring them back in, if we don't recognize that they have missed critical instructional time, we see students act out to escape academic tasks because most children would just like adults, would rather look bad than stupid. And so that self-fulfilling prophecy also leads to what is oftentimes referred to as the school to prison pipeline that Dr. Nelson will also speak to. What we see in schools as the children who are the recipients of harsh and disproportionate discipline are much more likely to drop out of school, to abuse substances, to end up incarcerated, to struggle academically, to have a harder time finding employment. That pipeline or that trajectory is a very real thing. And so we have schools doing something about it now. I feel, and I believe Dr. Gervin could also say this, that it feels like for years we have been admiring this problem, that we have lots and lots of national data that has shown us the negative impact that exclusion from the learning environment has on children. We've been admiring it and, oh, wow, how bad this is. But now in terms of actually addressing implicit bias, we have people disaggregating their school data, identifying when students are much more susceptible to harsh and disproportionate discipline and actually doing something about it. So when Dr. Gervin was talking about teaching individuals how to make better decisions, we have colleagues, including Dr. Gervin, Dr. Kent McIntosh, and many individuals across the nation who are helping educators identify what they call vulnerable decision points. Those moments in your day, whether you're hungry, tired, it's during a transition period or what have you, where you are much more likely to act on your implicit biases than other times. And when we know when those times are, we can actually do something about it. And so a strategy that is now being taught to educators is something identifying your neutralizing routine. What do you do in those moments instead of kicking a kid out of class or acting harshly towards them? What is something that allows you to take a breath, create some space, and act in a way that is much more aligned with your beliefs and values than acting in a way that will detrimentally impact a student and their outcomes? We also have colleagues who are really invested in developing and implementing anti-racist curricula. So at the University of Oregon, I have a colleague by the name of Dr. Joe Weaver, who has a podcast called Speaking of Race, in which they're looking at and exploring these topics from a biological perspective. And now taking podcasts and developing high school curricula. So anti-racist curriculum can be taught in social studies and biology classes, because this is so crucial. It's not just about adults doing something about it, but actually us investing in our generations of students and teaching them how to identify these biases, how to identify discrimination, and how to actively be a part of fighting against it and not admiring the problem. We're also working with colleagues who are invested in helping families have these conversations within their own homes, talking about issues and news that we see very much in the forefront of our media and the discussions that children are having. I think about a focus group that we did with eighth grade students, where a student, without even labeling implicit bias or disproportionate discipline, talked about seeing a friend in his class engage in the same unwanted behavior as him and watching that kid get into more trouble than he was. Students see these things and they're speaking directly to it. And so being able to work with schools and districts and communities to invest in teaching our students about these things and about how they combat implicit bias in their own actions within their home and within schools is so important. And so now I will turn it over to Justice Adrian Nelson to discuss implicit bias from a legal standpoint.
Thank you both, Dr. Gervin and Dr. Neese, for all of that wonderful and helpful information for those who have not been studying and researching the issue of implicit bias in general and how it applies in different areas of everyone's life. I'm going to talk about how implicit bias shows up in the court. And as Dr. Neese had referenced, there is a school to prison pipeline. And what that means is that depending on the circumstances by which you live, that doesn't mean things that you've done just by living in a certain zip code, just the color of your skin, your gender, sexual orientation, your religious affiliation, all of these factors can affect how one navigates the world. And we've had a lot of studies in our court systems, both nationally and regionally, but specifically locally, most recently in 2016 by the MacArthur Foundation, that showed that there was an overrepresentation of people of color, brown and black people, at every stage of the criminal justice system. But what does that mean? It means from being stopped by the police to going to prison. So that's from being stopped, being charged with a crime, having a trial, being sentenced, then going into custody and serving time either in a jail for the local sentence or prison for a more serious sentence, to probation. At every stage, there's an overrepresentation. Now, some people may say it's because of choices people made, but as I'm hoping you will learn from the presentations from my two previous presenters, there are other factors at play. Our courts in Oregon have had training for a number of years for the judges, but we realized that that wasn't enough. And so we've started doing trainings about this issue and how we interface with people as they come into our courts, because that matters. And we also support other areas of education, from district attorneys, prosecutors, to other lawyers, to defense attorneys, to people in the civil bar, because this affects everything. It doesn't just affect someone in a criminal way, which means taking away their liberty. It can affect if they get charged more for insurance rates, if they cannot get an interest rate that's based on their credit score and not other factors, which makes them be subject to predatory lending. We could go on and on and on. So what we found in our court in 2016 is that we needed to do something. Former Chief Justice Tom Barmer created a Council on Inclusion and Fairness. It's called the Oregon Supreme Court Council on Inclusion and Fairness. I have been a member of that council since its inception in fall of 2016, and I now chair it. Dr. Gervine is on a data committee of ours because we realized we needed to collect our own data so that we would know those points where we are doing okay, maybe well, and where we're falling short, to ensure that the courts belong to everyone. Chief Justice Walters, who is our current Chief Justice, created a strategic campaign. And she was specific, saying that it was a campaign to ensure that the courts are available to everyone, because that's a foundational statement that goes throughout the thread of our branch. And we said that because it was a concentrated commitment and effort to deliver commitments of enhancing public trust and confidence, improving access to justice, and improving services and outcome to the vulnerable, and creating an inclusive courthouse culture. And we have 19 initiatives that we're talking about doing that. In addition, we are supporting multiple efforts from a variety of areas in our legal system. For example, the Council on Inclusion and Fairness endorsed an unconscious bias jury video that was created by a group of judges and lawyers. I happen to be one of them. And we came together over a number of years, actually three, and called ourselves the Committee on Bias in the Justice System in Oregon, to create a video for jurors coming in to serve and perform their civic duty to understand how unconscious implicit bias can affect your decision-making and how to give some tools to help you interrupt that and focus on the law and the evidence through witness testimony and exhibits you would have in the courtroom. So we're trying to start with awareness and build with the data and also support ways of addressing it. Now, in case you didn't know, Oregon was the last state to have non-unanimous jury verdicts. Now, what does that mean? That meant that there was an overrepresentation of people who were vulnerable, marginalized, not having a voice, often people of color that were given harsher sentences. It was actually created, the idea of not having a unanimous verdict was not necessarily based on Black people in Oregon. It was based on Jewish. It was anti-Semitic. And it happened, and we had never addressed it in trying to change it. It came until 2 years ago that Oregon and Louisiana were the only two states in the country that still had non-unanimous verdicts, which were shown to have a discriminatory effect. Louisiana, through its voting process, changed the law. Oregon was forced when the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this year in April issued United States versus Ramos. And if you looked at it, you thought it was dealing with Louisiana. It was dealing with another subset, but it was really talking about Oregon. So our court, the court that I sit on, has just issued a series of about seven opinions total. We did two earlier in the fall and five in December that address those issues and those cases that now have to be retried. That's an example of our court trying to acknowledge that we need to acknowledge that there is bias and how to interrupt it so that our courts can be fully fair. Another example is in light of the racial reckoning that happened in 2020, our Supreme Court was one of a number of state Supreme Courts that issued a statement. We made some commitments to look at our system and try and do better and interrupt things as much as we can. We're not giving specifics because that means that other people are going to say that we're trying to then reverse it and be discriminatory toward another group. That is not what we're trying to say. But we're saying we have to address these unconscious issues that have come up from us growing up, how we see things. It's not necessarily you are choosing to be that way, but when we see the result, we need to try and do things to interrupt and be different. There are a number of resources that are out there beside our video. We have bench cards, which is kind of the checklist that Dr. Gervin was talking about. We've had additional trainings. We're having listening sessions. We are having sessions where we can not assume we know how we're doing as a court. We are wanting to hear from people who have participated, from jurors, to witnesses, to defendants, to family, to friends, of all of those participants so that we can understand if we're living up to ensuring that the courts belong to all. So it's important that we let you know that we all are human, because we all are. And I know sometimes when people see judges in robes, they have a variety of opinions. And that's okay, because we have to have a conversation. For example, in the video, and we can send that link out to you so you can see it, you don't have to be called for jury duty in order to watch this video and learn something from it. I use myself as an example. I am the first Black person to sit on an appellate court in the state of Oregon. So people may make some assumptions about me. They may make some assumptions about how I got there. I thought that I could use myself as an example to have people say, oh, let me see what I think. And let me see what other people may think, because as we've said, people have different experiences and they may not be having the same experience or the same thought process. But it was a way to have a conversation about how someone like me may show up in the legal system and if people think that I fit. And so, and if I don't fit, let's talk about why you think I don't fit and where is that coming from? So we're having a lot of conversations about that, not only just about race, also about gender, also about religion, also about all of the other things that come up. For example, we're having some new policies put out on gender neutral bathrooms. We're developing an equity lens to look at everything that we do so that we can make sure that it's being as fair as possible, besides supporting not only the video, supporting the training. We're trying to make sure that we have inroads for people to provide opportunities to give us feedback. And we're also trying to make sure as we have courtrooms and courthouses built and renovated, that they have multiple languages available. So we recognize that our country for a long time only had a recognition of English, but we have so many people and we're with technology able to communicate and help people navigate, because if people feel seen, they will engage. And if they engage, they are productive. And that's what we want in our society. We want engaged, informed, productive citizens so that we can live up to what our country wants it to be. Thank you. We're now going to go to the question and answer session.
I'm Joel Corin, coordinator of this program for the program committee. We're now going to move into the questioning session and start with Kitty Piercy.
Thank you. My question is to everyone, but it is justice system related. So I think the justice is the key here. But I think about what we're trying to do with the looking at our police force in Eugene right now and people meeting and trying to figure out how improvements can be made. And I think I'd like to hear what you know about how our police are trained in relationship to implicit bias and what is going on with that right now.
So I don't have a lot of specific information about the training of the officers other than the statewide training that they do, and they have some hours that they have to have on the training, and then they go into their local jurisdictions and they may do some additional training over a period of time. And that's not something that our courts necessarily monitor, because that's separate and apart for us, although we're all participants and partners in this legal system and people see us as a whole. What I can say as a parallel is, as a lawyer, even though I'm a justice, the bottom line is I'm a lawyer, I have to do continuing education. Lawyers always like to put legal stuff in it, so we call it continuing legal education. And so we have to have so much training on access to justice, which includes equity and all kinds of things, as well as elder abuse and other issues to make sure that we're current. So I can tell you what we're doing, and I know that they do some, but I don't have specifics.
Does anybody else have, the other speakers have any? I'm just concerned because I think people's first response when they have an interaction with the police is what kind of biases do the police bring into that first interaction, and what kind of experience is that for the person who's intersecting with the police department?
So I agree with you. I agree with you. And I think that there is a way to try and bridge that in some ways, particularly through the art. For those of you who are not aware, there is a nonprofit organization called the Red Door Project. And what the Red Door Project has done as its mission is work to change the racial ecology of the world, but they're starting in Oregon. So about 4 years ago, I would say, give or plus a year or two, because my memory is not always as accurate as I would like for it to be, they did what was called monologues. And they did a monologue that was called Hands Up. And it was the experience of seven people of color. I would say they were identified as Black people, different ages, different geographies, different life experiences, and their perspective of interaction with police. As a result of that, the project and the founders, Leslie Moniz and Kevin, losing Kevin's last name. It'll come up for me in a little bit. Created Cop Out, which was the law enforcement's response and how they were dealing with interacting in the world, particularly if they were police of color. And then it evolved to what their project is now, where it is a mixture of both of those experiences, and they're adding new ones. For example, they're working on a monologue from a judicial perspective. So it is a way to begin a conversation as well as explore reforms through the arts. So if you're not aware of that, maybe you want to check into that, and I'm happy to provide a link to the to Mr. Corin, since he's in charge today, to give some more information to those who are interested.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else?
I can add a bit to that. Is I know that the State Police Academy has a training that includes concepts around stereotyping and implicit bias, those sort of automatic assumptions. And the Eugene Police Department has had trainings around those topics. I think this goes back a little bit to what I talked about in the general area, is it's important to have those. It's important to have those for raising awareness. And we know from a lot of research on it that awareness itself isn't an effective intervention, that being aware that we have them. And so knowing that we make those automatic assumptions, I think hopefully is a spur to or a prompt, helps with motivation to adopt the kind of more empathetic, more tailored policies and practices. Rhonda talked about, Dr. Neese talked about them a little bit in some of the educational settings. Justice Nelson talked about some of those specific changes in the judicial settings, but adopting those kinds of actual policy changes that matter about how we interact with people. And one other piece that I'll throw in there, because I know that we have a lot of questions in the queue, is that when we talk about implicit bias, we are talking about this, again, the automatic assumptions that sort of I may have when I see people and make assumptions about them. What's left out of that picture is what it feels like to have people making those assumptions about you, right? And the concept of implicit bias doesn't sort of capture those. And in that interaction, as you mentioned, there's a lot of uncertainty, right? There's a lot of assumptions around what is a police officer thinking? What is my neighbor thinking? Police officers having to deal with assumptions that somebody might have made when they decided to make a call in the first place, right? In terms of community members and those bias and assumptions. And the whole situation is rife with a lot of uncertainty. So thinking through in an empathetic and planful way about how we design our processes to address all of that, frankly, a lot of the subjectivity that goes in there. And there are interventions aside from the trainings. I think a lot of it goes back to those kinds of interactions that we hope people have. Sometimes goes under the community-based policing sort of nomenclature. I know in Oregon, and I'm not familiar about the Eugene Police Department specific, but for example, the Building Bridges of Understanding programs that were done with the Muslim Educational Trust, I think in Tigard and Tualatin. And the whole idea of those was actually to bring law enforcement and the community they policed together to talk about those mutual experiences so that they know each other and essentially get this idea that if you assume an Oregonian, for example, or somebody who lives in Eugene or Lane County looks a particular way, to help disrupt that assumption that we are people who live in this area and call it our homes, look quite differently from one another and have different perspectives. And so to have people interact actually on an individual basis and spend a day together and talk together and have some tough conversations together so that they know each other and can help think about those, so they can interact in a way that helps them break down some of those assumptions, given that there's going to be some uncertainty in those interactions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is by Andrew College.
Thank you, Joel, and thank you to the panelists. My question flows from the last one, and that is that there have been several academic critiques of implicit bias training, which is, you know, not the only tool in the tool chest, of course, but one of them that's frequently the choice of particularly corporate America. And this was most recently noted by David Brooks in the New York Times column just this week. So my question for you is both how do you sort of respond to those critiques of what has become now a very common element in many people's lives, the training, but also sort of more importantly, how do we test that what we are doing, whether it's training or otherwise, is actually working? What should we be looking for as a proof of concept so that we know what to replicate and know what doesn't work? Thanks so much again.
Maybe I'll start off with this one and then kick it off. So yeah, so there's a lot of critiques around implicit bias training, and the way I think about it is twofold. There is not a lot of evidence that I mentioned a couple of times that awareness actually does anything. And by what I mean anything is results in the kinds of changes to the underlying behaviors we're really concerned about. So an implicit bias training by itself, being more aware of the concept of implicit bias, doesn't actually reduce discrimination in suspensions and expulsions, right, or disparities in schools. And so when we think about those critiques are very well taken. And as somebody who actually, who cares about those behaviors, and this is to the second part of your question, that's what I look towards. Mm-hmm. Are the things we're doing effective at closing the gaps between how different groups are treated? Awareness might be, someone might theorize that that's a mechanism to doing that. And it turns out that it's not really. However, awareness can help people adopt the kinds of policies and practices that are themselves effective. So if all you do is tell somebody about implicit bias and then step back and say, now that you're aware, we assume you will be unbiased, that's not going to work. But if what we do is, and there's a fair amount of research on this as well, that if what you do is you talk about implicit bias as a way to motivate or get people to think about adopting some of the policies and practices that do change behaviors and decision-making, we have evidence that those work.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Gervin. Thank you, Andrew, for that question, because, you know, it was something that I struggled with. I'll give you a personal story. Dr. Gervin and I do implicit bias trainings for faculty at the University of Oregon as part of an obligation that they have before they serve on a hiring committee. So they have to go through implicit bias training because we know that implicit bias impacts the decisions we make when we look to who to invite for job interviews, for example. And the very first one I did, I had a student, a woman of color, come up to me and say that for me, she said, watching you as a woman of color talk about implicit bias broke my heart because I find that implicit bias trainings are incredibly whitewashed. And I remember even coming to Dr. Gervin, I don't know if you remember this, this was a number of years ago, and saying she was absolutely right. Because if we don't couch it within the fact that this is one tiny piece of a much larger puzzle, we're missing the point. Discussions about implicit bias and implicit bias trainings do not focus on explicit bias. They don't focus on systemic racism. They don't talk about historical racism. We're talking about unconscious behaviors that lead us to act in biased ways. And so without presenting it like that, we risk alienating people. And like you're saying, leading into practices that it's like, okay, so you've made me aware of my implicit bias, now what? So for us, it's important that individuals that go through implicit bias training, regardless of what it is addressing, that we're giving them tools and strategies that actively combat against the impact of those biases. So for example, the ones that we do for individuals serving on hiring committees, we give recommendations in terms of what typically leads to biased decisions. So first off, for example, masking the names of individuals on their CVs is very important because what we know from implicit bias research is that when we are presented with two CVs or resumes that are identical, and we have one with a historically or traditionally white male name and one with the name of a woman of color, we know who's being invited for the job interview. It's traditionally white males. So it is irrelevant to know the name of the person on a CV. So why not block that? Another one is pedigree, right? We know that people are biased to inviting candidates from Ivy League universities, for example, for job interviews. Does it matter where they got their PhD? Does it matter? You know, in some instances it might, especially if they come from a hub of people doing research in a specific area. But if it's irrelevant to whether or not this person would be an excellent candidate for the job, why not mask that? It's the same with students at the university. Why not mask their names when we go through grading? We know as instructors, we have biases and favoritism towards people who show up to class and people who are actively engaged. But is that bias going to impact my grading? You know, and so really it focuses on what are these strategies. And it, for us as scientists or people who do research, to ask, is what we're doing effective? When we do these trainings with schools, we are looking at monthly their school data and disaggregating their discipline data by race. And we're looking at the issues in which they had before and the actual strategies that they're putting in place and seeing if that disproportionate discipline is reducing. We cannot do these things without collecting data. We cannot do these things even at the university without seeing, look at our hiring pool, look how who we're inviting. Has this been impacted by implementing strategies to combat our implicit biases?
One thing I'll throw on that too is that in the last couple of years, the legislatively creative and then the state criminal justice commission's efforts to collect data, the STOP data, which they do annual reports now, progress that, is beginning to create a database that actually allows for the testing of what's effective, where problems are, and what's effective at those particular levels. And fortunately, at least for some schools, we have that data already, so we can do that process of looking at what's effective. But the thing we most care about is that kind of end behavior.
And what I would say is that I think that no one should take a training and think that it's going to somehow undo years, in some points, decades, and sometimes centuries of behavior. That it is going to have to take a commitment to incorporate this into your life and to try and undo. And with a recognition that it's going to be sometimes helpful and successful and sometimes not. That it's not a one size fits all, a one and done, even a five times and done. It's going to take an ongoing commitment once you're aware to continue to work lifelong on trying to interrupt and unlearn certain types of behavior.
Okay, the next question is by Margaret Halleck.
Yes, I also want to thank the panelists for the great work that you're doing. It's led a lot of people into trying to understand their own behaviors for a number of years. But I was going to ask Andrew's question, so I'll just put a little spin on it. I've been reading Cast by Isabel Wilkerson, that Origins of Our Discontents. And she takes implicit bias and really puts it in a much more concrete and deeper context, in that she says it leads to notions of hierarchy and assumptions about the value of different people, and that it's based on centuries of our neurological responses to white superiority, which was the basis, slavery, enslaving people, based on notions of superiority and inferiority. And so those implicit biases are really deep, and they're dangerous, and they're very hard to eliminate. She does recommend what Eric said about radical empathy, but also kind of more truth and reconciliation, you know, deeper processes that really get down to, like, not whitewashing this, you know, just like what are the real dangers here? So I just, I wondered if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I can tell you that I have read Cast. I actually watched her interview that she did with during the Portland Book Festival, and where she discussed it. And I am in two book groups. I'm going to be discussing Cast for a second time on Wednesday. And then the following Tuesday, I'm going to have another conversation. I think it's a book that everybody should read to really understand maybe some of the resistance that people may feel toward this topic. the fact that she shows parallels from the country of India, the country of Germany, and the United States, and what is continuing to happen, and that Germany is the only one that has really addressed the issue and been able to dismantle it. And it's not without controversy, but it has been a countrywide acceptance and recognition where they work to acknowledge their past with the caste system and how it's they were going to move forward. So I think radical empathy that she recommended and that Dr. Gervine mentioned is critical. And but it's all, there's a theme going on. It's about awareness, acceptance, and then moving forward with truth and love. Because we're not talking about how if we don't see each other and respect each other and not see each other as human, we can't connect with one another. And there has to be that connection and acknowledgement that systems were put in place for not good reasons, for reasons to make people feel less than, because maybe you were feeling a little insecure yourself. So that was a way for you to kind of keep people down, to make yourself feel good. And if we can get to that place, I think we can go a long way. So I think that CAST is an excellent example. I know a lot of people who in different communities who have the Everyone Read program. It's like their Everybody Reads for 2021. So I'm hoping to see some change. But again, it's something that's going to have to be studied and kind of followed up on, because it's not, what I do understand from history, things just don't happen. Right. It can take a small group of people to affect change, and it then becomes that pebble that becomes that ripple that becomes that longer ripple and just becomes. But you have to be intentional.
We have time for one very quick question and one very quick answer. Ingrid Kessler is the next questioner.
Thank you so much to all our speakers for joining us at City Club. I am a brand new member from last year. This question is mostly for Dr. Gervin, but I'll take all the answers I can get. I really appreciate the remarks about, you know, when we're looking at how can we make things better, you mentioned that one of the best things to do is to work in groups and socialize in groups where people look all different kinds of ways. We wear different clothes. Maybe we have a different skin color. Maybe we have accents. I love where I live in unincorporated rural Lane County, but that does not describe my neighborhood. And so it really lacks diversity, I think, to put it a little bluntly, where I live. So short of meeting in groups that look that way, what can I do and what can my neighbors do to just make things better? And thank you again so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you for having us and thank you for the question. Yeah, it's a question I get a lot working in and around Oregon in a lot of different areas. And I think there are a couple of different answers. One is, of course, we do have, particularly now the pandemic has highlighted our virtual space. And there are ways to connect outside of our local communities. And we can do things where physical proximity isn't necessarily the only way to gather. So that's one answer. And it's not that it's easier, right? If you walk around Washington, D.C., it would be easier to find a diverse group of people to have conversations and a meal with than it might be in certain areas of Oregon. And particularly how you define diversity, right? Because usually there's socioeconomic diversity, other things, although neighborhoods might lack that also, depending on where they are. And so to the extent you live in an area that doesn't have those, you do have to get more creative and take the effort and maybe make the effort to do that. The other piece, which comes up sometimes, is relates to some of those historical things and understanding why it is that there might not be diversity in some areas where we are. And so a conversation that came up a lot this summer working with a lot of folks around justice reinvestment in Oregon is a discussion that one implication of why of realizing that there isn't a lot of maybe racial, ethnic, or other diversity around where you live is thinking about the fact that that often isn't an accident and embracing the implications of that, if for no other reason than that empathy and the motivation that it may take some extra work to try to overcome it. and making sure that, you know, it's not because people aren't welcome now, because there are a lot of places that are not diverse because people don't feel welcome today to be there. And so trying to take the efforts that's necessary to overcome that too.
Thank you to the presenters and thank you to the questioners. That concludes our program for today. And I'd like to turn the program back over to our president, Scott Coltrane.
This has been City Club's January 8th, 2020 program, Implicit Bias in the Schools, in the Courts, and in Society. Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our Diamond sponsors. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities they serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, Peace Health's mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. LCC provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. I would also like to acknowledge some gold sponsors: Evans, Elder, Brown, and Schubert, Dr. Sandy Ibarra Hearing Associates, and our Sapphire sponsor, Summit Bank. Support for the City Club comes from Summit Bank, your local community bank, an independent community bank headquartered in Eugene. Summit Bank serves businesses and professionals in the Eugene-Springfield area and Central Oregon communities. For more information, visit sbko.bank. Before we thank our speakers today, there are a few quick announcements. Thank you to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Pack Info and Simplified Computing, LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography. And a special thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page starting at noon on Fridays. Next week, we will have a program spotlighting the economic challenges and opportunities on the Oregon coast. As the new year dawns, communities throughout the Oregon coast face unique economic challenges and opportunities. On the one hand, as recently detailed by the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, rural Oregon, including the coast, has lost a smaller share of jobs than urban Oregon since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. On the other, prior to the onset of the pandemic, rural Oregon had barely regained the level of jobs prior to the Great Recession of 2007-09, continuing a troubling pattern of lagging economic growth. The effects of this geographic inequality go far beyond economics, affecting everything from life expectancy to access to health insurance. Please join us again on Friday, January 15th. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, I would like to thank today's speakers for a great program: Dr. Eric Gervin, Dr. Rhonda Neese, and Justice Adrian Nelson. Thank you very much for all the work you do and for sharing with us. This concludes today's program. Be well and stay safe.